Okay, so it's a couple minutes early, but let me just start. So welcome to 377. My name is Prashant Chinoy. I'll be the instructor for this course, and I'll be helped by at least one, if not two TAs for this course, who I will introduce to you maybe next time. Okay, so what I would like to do today is just go through the syllabus for the course, talk about the course structure, policies, prerequisites that we assume for the course, and then I will give a quick introduction to the topic of operating system and what we will want to get out of this class. Okay, so the first part of the lecture is organizational. The second part is basically an introduction. Okay, so the most important thing to keep in mind is everything that I cover here will also be posted on the course webpage, and that's the URL for the course webpage. I'll show you what it looks like in just a moment. Okay, this basically the TA for the course is going to be Vimal. That is his email address. I will have him come here and introduce himself to you next time. Okay, I couldn't get hold of him this morning, so probably going to be, if we have a discussion section tomorrow, you'll probably see him there, but otherwise he'll come next time. Okay, there is a discussion section for this course. It's going to be on Wednesdays in the e-lab. Okay, the discussion section usually supplements what we cover here in class. Okay, so it will either be additional material on the lectures, or when we kick off with the programming assignments, we will basically use the discussion section to build on what you are doing. Okay, either introduce additional concepts that are necessary for the assignment, provide help, Q&A, that kind of stuff. Okay, so it is important to also attend the discussion section. Okay, the course doesn't end with the lectures. The discussion will substantially supplement what we are going to do in the class here. Okay, the TAs will typically be responsible for the discussion section, not me, but I will make sure that they use that time well to supplement what we do here. The course assumes prereqs. I assume that if you are already registered in Spire, you have satisfied the prereqs as they are checked in Spire. So essentially you need knowledge of data structures and 201 like course, which is basic knowledge of architecture. Okay, and we'll talk about, you'll understand why when we do an introduction to the whole topic next time. Okay, so basically since we are looking at operating systems, there's some assumption that you know about what a machine looks like, what the hardware looks like, because the OS is the piece of software that runs right above the hardware. Okay, and applications run on top of the OS. So you need to know really what your machine looks like in order to understand the intricacies of what operating systems do. Okay, so basic knowledge is okay, but you do need to know something. Okay, there is a textbook for this course. Okay, the recommended text is Operating Systems Concepts by Shilber Schatz. There are multiple editions of this book available. Okay, the most recent one is the 8th edition, and the 8th edition itself comes in two flavors. Okay, there's a normal Operating Systems Concepts, and there's one called OS Operating System Concepts with Java. They're not very different. Okay, so if you get your hand on either the 7th edition, which was the previous one, or your 8th edition, that should be sufficient. Okay, so that, which means if you want to get a used copy and it's one edition old, perfectly okay. Okay, I haven't actually requested the textbook annex to stock this, because I'm not sure how many of you actually use the textbook annex anymore. Okay, there are multiple avenues to buy this book. Amazon sells this book, the Kindle edition of this book, for half of what you would pay for the hard copy, for instance. Okay, so if you want to buy the Kindle edition, feel free. You don't need a Kindle, I presume you know that. You don't need a Kindle to read the Kindle edition. You can just get a Kindle reader for your PC or Mac. Okay, and then you can save some money. So if you want me to have them stock it, I'm happy to do it. But it has been my experience that few people are actually now using the textbook annex, and people just go online and just find a good deal and buy it that way, or go to some other bookstores. So do you have a preference? Do you want me to have them order it, or would you like to just use some other mechanisms to buy it? I will also put this on reserve, incidentally, in the library. So if you want to just borrow the library copy or go to the library to use it, that would be fine. Any preferences? Anyone wants? Yes.
Sorry, so you said you're going to put it on an e-book and a Braille one or something?
Not the library will be a hard copy reserves in the library. So you can go there, look at the book. They won't let you take it out.
Okay.
Okay. Great. What I was saying was you can buy an e-book version, and what I noticed, it is cheaper than buying a hard copy. Okay, so if you want to go down that route, feel free to do it. Okay? Anybody wants me to ask the textbook people to get it? I'd like to get it online, okay. So, if you have a preference or if you are going to get it online, you just get the version with Java. Although I said that if the price is the same, go with this version because the course will be in Java. But if you find some other version which is the standard version or a older version, that's fine. Okay, it doesn't really matter. Okay, there's another reference book. This is not required. Okay, but I will also put this on reserves. But if you have it, it would be helpful to supplement the concept. This is the Modern Operating Systems book, okay, by Tannenbaum, third edition, okay, as is mentioned here. Okay, that's the text. This is just suggested additional reading. Okay, just keep that in mind. Okay, as far as course requirements go, you will be graded on a combination of homeworks and in-class assignments, programming assignments and exams. Okay, there will be up to maybe 5 or 6 homeworks. Okay, that will basically force you to keep reading up on the material. So you don't just read up the day before the exam, but the homeworks will make you pace yourself through the course. It's 15% of the grade. 4 programming assignments. The first one is actually not very difficult. It's just a warm-up assignment. So there are really 3 assignments, with the first one being a warm-up one, just to make sure you know enough Java to take this course. That's going to be 45% of the grade. 3 exams, 2 midterm and a final, around 40%. Okay, so that's basically how you are going to be graded in this course. Okay, so there will be in-class assignments, maybe in the discussion sections, occasionally in the lectures. That will go, will supplement the homeworks. Okay, any questions on this? Yes.
How are the programming assignments graded?
How are they graded, meaning?
Yeah. Is it through an auto-grader?
Okay, no, I will talk about that. There's no auto-grader here because we are going to be using Java, which is different from what was done earlier. So that the whole thing was built for C and C++, so I'm not going to use the auto-grader. Okay? Yeah. There are late policies basically for your programming assignments. You will get 3 late days as is norm for this course. So all of that is spelled on the detailed syllabus on the web page. Do review that. The strict policies on cheating your work really needs to be your own. Don't go borrow code from someone else or go look up snippets on the web or anything like that. Make sure your assignments are your own. Okay, because they are checked using an automated program against some database. Make sure that you don't borrow stuff that you shouldn't. Okay. EdLab is available for those of you who want to use EdLab machines. Most of you probably will prefer to use your laptop, and that's fine. Okay, but if you want to use the EdLab, it's there for you. All of you will get accounts on the EdLab. I'm still debating whether you will submit in the EdLab or whether you will upload your code to Spark. Okay, we are going to use Spark, which is the UMass system for online courses. Okay, so I'm not sure which of the two will do. Homeworks you are definitely going to upload to Spark. Okay, so you will basically, you can take your written homework, scan it, or you can just type up your homework in Word or whatever word processor you want, and you will upload it. Okay, so we will actually have that mechanism for submission. It will timestamp, it will make sure homeworks don't get lost and all of those nice things that come with it. Okay, as far as assignments go, I am not yet sure, so we will think about it and design the right policy there. Okay, I already mentioned the discussion section, which will help you with the lab assignments. All assignments are in Java. Okay, so if you don't know C, C++, don't have to worry, because I switched the course back to Java. But that assumes that you do know Java, which I presume you should, okay, because most of the earlier courses use Java. Okay. So my office hours, are basically on Tuesdays and Thursdays right after the lecture. So it's convenient if you have a question comes up in the lecture, you can just walk up right after class, talk to me after the lecture, and we can clarify any questions you may have. I said TA is going to be Vimal. His office hours I will announce, because I couldn't get hold of him this morning. I don't have his exact office hours, but he is going to at least have two slots, one on Mondays and one on Fridays. And Wednesday is your discussion section. So 4 of the 5 days you will be able to see one of us if you have any questions. So I think that should hopefully allow plenty of contact hours if you have questions and whatnot. Okay, so I already mentioned projects are 45%, exams 40%, the remainder goes to the homeworks. Okay, so projects are in Java. So there's a plagiarism policy, and I would like you to take it seriously. Okay, so it's posted on the syllabus. It's basically summarized here. So we don't allow borrowing code from someone, giving your code to someone, either this year or after you finish this course. Okay, copying from any place, okay, including the net. Okay, getting someone to write your code for you. Okay, and submitting anyone else's code as your own, or looking at someone's. Okay, basically common sense things that you should keep in mind. And we will enforce policies on academic honesty. Okay, this is just to make sure you get enough from your class and not try to get by without doing the work that we expect you to do. Okay, so do take a few moments to review this policy. I think there is nothing in there that should surprise you. At the end of the day, the bottom line is your work is your own. Okay, I mean, if you will have group projects, so meaning your work is your group's work and not someone else's work. Okay, that's what we will assume here. There's a form that I will expect all of you to sign that says you agree to this policy. Okay, then you will adhere to it. Okay, there's also a cell phone and laptop policy, which is again common sense. Okay, make sure that when you come to class, put your cell phones on silent so it doesn't disrupt your class. Okay, you can certainly bring laptops into the class. That's not a problem. But when you are here during a lecture, make sure you use it to take notes or do something. Okay, not to start doing Facebook and Twitter and those kinds of other things. That, I mean, if you want to do that, there's no reason to be here. Okay, you are welcome not to come if you are not interested in the lecture. Okay, I'm not enforcing any mandatory attendance or anything like that. So if you come here, come because you're interested in the class, and then pay attention and not do something that distracts you and people who are sitting around you. Okay, there's a small penalty that I will enforce at my discretion if things become disruptive. I expect that there will be some cell phones that will go off no matter what, even though I put this policy up, but try to adhere to it. Okay, make sure that we respect each other in the class during lectures. Okay, so are there any questions on that? It's basically the syllabus. Here is an outline of the course as we'll see. There are 4 main components. Okay, so the course, there are 4 big parts. I will do some introductory material in the next 2 or 3 classes, but then we'll start on the first major component, which is going to be on processes and threads. Okay. Then there's another large component on memory management, one on storage and file system, then one on distributed system. Okay, these are sort of the 4 big topics. Each of these topics will probably take several lectures to cover. Okay, if you look at the textbook, those are the 4 major areas that are also covered in the textbook. Any operating system that you see today, whether it is Windows or Mac or Linux or any AIX, HP UX, they would have these key components in them. Okay, that's the reason the course is structured in this fashion. Okay, so before I actually do a quick introduction, let me just show you the course webpage. Not the web page. Okay, so it's the usual stuff here. The course syllabus that I was mentioning is here. Okay, everything I talked about is spelled in some detail there. Okay, so you will see all the course requirements and whatnot. Okay, that's one thing. But the more important thing for you is that's interesting. I think I changed the name. Oh, okay. So I post all the course notes here. Okay, so including all my slides will be here. You see that I'm recording the class. So all the audio feeds will be put up there, also made available as a podcast. Okay, so it's all available from this page. You will see that I already put up today's slides. So you don't really have to take notes. I will make sure the slides become available maybe half an hour before the lecture. Okay, so you are welcome to print it, bring it to class and take notes. That way you don't have to write down everything I say. So that's basically the slides for today's class. Okay, and the notes, there will be a scribe who will take some notes. We'll put that up. Audio recordings of the class will be put up here, as will be homeworks, handouts and programming assignments. Okay, so everything is available of this one page. Okay, so keep that in mind. Any questions on the course content syllabus? Okay. This is not a reason to not come to class, incidentally. Okay, don't assume that because I put up the recorded lectures, there's no reason to come to class. You will see that your performance will suffer. Okay, just hearing the audio feed is not the same as coming to class. It's made available as a convenience so you can review things later. Okay. Okay. So with that, let's do a quick. Okay, so administrivia. So there are several people who emailed me saying they needed overrides and whatnot. Okay, so I have some forms here. If you brought a form with you and you haven't gotten into the class, come see me at the end of today's class. I'll sign off on the forms and then you can be registered. Okay, is there other substantial number of you who haven't registered and who hasn't yet signed up? Okay, just a few of you. Okay, so come see me after class. Okay, so we can get those details out of the way. Okay, so that's basically the syllabus. What I want to do is just give a quick, maybe 20-minute introduction to what is an operating system, just review the history of operating system, just to set the context, okay, for the remainder of the class, I mean the rest of the course. Okay, so what is an operating system? There are several definitions you will find, okay, depending on where you look. The original definition of operating system was basically whatever is constitutes your operating system kernel that is running on your machine is the OS for the these days, I mean, the OS doesn't reside just in the kernel. There are several components that run outside it. So the definition or the boundary of what constitutes an operating system has changed over the years as different architectures have been used to build operating systems and as operating systems have evolved. Okay? But basically, at the end of the day, rather than looking at the boundary, here is a more abstract or a conceptual definition of an operating system. Okay, it's essentially the interface between the end user, which is you, or your applications and the underlying hardware. Okay, it's a thing that sits between you and the hardware. Okay, and it essentially implements a logical interface. Okay, that gives you a easier to use abstraction. Okay, so you don't really need to know the underlying details of the hardware on your machine. What is it running? How much RAM does it have? How much disk space does it have? The operating system deals with it for you. Okay, it presents the disk as a more convenient abstraction of a file system. Okay, so you don't deal with messy disk blocks and whatnot. You just create files. Files stay in folder. So you have all these nicer abstractions that are provided that makes it easier for you to use your machine. Okay, that's basically conceptually what an OS is. Okay. Here is what an OS is not. There are many definitions of what is included in an OS, which includes everything from applications like your browser and whatnot. Those are applications as far as we are concerned and not part of the OS. Okay. Only the system software that really sits between the applications and the hardware is what we will call an operating system. Okay. And the boundary of what an OS is will be different based on the platform. Okay. So the boundary of where you would draw the boundary between the user space and the kernel space for Windows may not be exactly the same in Linux, may not be exactly the same in Mac OS X and other platforms. But essentially, it's the thing that sits in between. Okay, as is shown in the picture here, this is your hardware. it presents a physical machine interface. Okay, here you have basically things like registers and memory banks and the system bus and all the hardware peripherals at a very low level. Okay, users will typically not deal with their machine at this level of abstraction. Okay, instead what you do is you run the operating system, okay, which deals with all the low level hardware and presents a virtual machine or a logical machine interface. Okay, so you processors you don't really deal with, okay, RAM you don't really deal with, you just start your application, do your work, shut down applications. The OS really deals with how the applications or the processes are mapped into hardware, how they load into RAM, how they access your storage and whatnot. Okay, so that's the key component that we want to study in this course. Okay, so what is this thing that sits between the hardware and the applications? What abstractions does it provide? How does it manage all the hardware resources? Those are really things that we are interested in. Okay, the other thing it does is it provides this illusion of a bigger, faster and a more reliable system. Okay, because many operating systems are able to deal with simple hardware failures, okay, of various sorts. So you plug in a USB thumb drive, you unplug it without unmounting it. As far as the OS is concerned, that's a small failure, but it can deal with it. Your machine doesn't have to crash for this small error that you made. Okay, so it provides better abstraction. Okay? It is also like a government where it is managing resources. Okay? When resources are in demand, the operating system is that piece of software that decides which applications get how many resources. If you start up a number of applications or processes, the OS will decide how much RAM each of them should get, which pages will reside in memory, which ones will not. Okay, so it's essentially making decisions for you, and it's basically dividing up the resources. Okay, and you will also have to pay for these for this management, because there's going to be some overhead for running your operating system. Okay, it's basically sitting in between, so it has to intervene whenever your applications try to access hardware resources, so it will add some overhead. Okay, but hopefully the benefits will outweigh this costs or overheads, and you will basically want to use this better abstraction rather than having to deal with the hardware at a lower level of abstraction. Okay, that's basically a very high level overview, not overview, but high level definition of what we will assume is an operating system. Okay, now this is an active field that is evolving. Okay, I mean there have been operating systems that have been designed since the early 60s, okay, and there are still new ones being designed today, although probably not in ways you think of operating system. Okay, so the demands as hardware evolves, so do operating system. There are new areas that span the web, the grid, and then these days there is talk of this notion of cloud computing. All of them have operating systems that have been designed specifically to address these needs. Okay? Hardware continues to evolve, okay, and then so much the operating system, because it's always the thing that manages the hardware. Okay? And then there is also this vibrant area of open source operating system. Okay? There are a variety of them, the most famous being Linux, but there's FreeBSD and a whole bunch of others. Okay? For these open source platform, source code is available. There's a large number of volunteers that continue to develop, evolve the operating system. Okay, so you can actually look at the operating system source for many of these platforms to get a better understanding of what operating systems do. Okay, so just as an aside, I also teach a course called 577. Okay, some of you may have heard of it. That's a course on programming the Linux kernel. Okay, we are not going to do anything like that in this class. Okay? But once you have the background on operating systems, once you have taken 377, there is a follow-on course called 577, okay, which some of you or some small subset of you will take, where we actually look at the Linux kernel, look at various components of the kernel, modify it and so on. Okay? And there are platforms, because they are open source, you can actually do that. Okay? They also make good platforms for research in addition to education. Okay, so just going into a little more detail, okay, there are several things that an operating system does. Okay, it provides several system services. Okay, we will look at several of them. Okay, there are file system services, there are virtual memory services, networking services, and CPU scheduling, time sharing, and so on. We are actually going to look at them in the opposite order. We'll start with processes and threads, as I mentioned, which will involve CPU scheduling, we will look at then memory management, which is virtual memory, demand paging, and so on. We'll look at file systems, okay? And then the last component is networking and distributed system. Okay? So the OS essentially coordinates multiple applications and users that are trying to access the machine. Okay, in most cases, okay, today, if you have your own laptop, there's only one user, i.e. you, that is using that machine. Okay? That need not be the case for larger systems, okay, which it could be servers or other kinds of systems where multiple users may be accessing them. And the OS has to arbitrate across the demands that multiple users are making. Each user may have started a number of applications or processes that are all concurrently running on that machine. Okay? So, the OS also has to arbitrate across these processes as they make competing demands. Okay? Each process may want a lot of memory, and your system may have limited amounts of RAM, maybe it's 4 gigabytes. Okay? But if you start 100 processes, the aggregate needs of these processes may exceed the size of RAM. Okay? How should the OS decide which application gets how much RAM? Okay. These are all decisions, coordination decisions that the OS has to do, which is concurrency, memory protection, networking, and there is a component which we will not go into a whole lot of detail here, which is security. Okay. How do you ensure that one process does not get inadvertent access to either the RAM or data that another process has created? Okay. So these are services that then OS has provide, and the goal typically for an OS designer is to design an OS system, okay, that makes the machine convenient to use, okay, which is basically a software engineering problem. Okay, what is the interface, what is the GUI that you use, and so on, and you also want it to be efficient to use, okay, which means the OS shouldn't really add a huge amount of overhead that substantially slows everything down. Okay, it should have minimal overhead and let you use the machine or let you use all the capabilities of your machine. So the second one, which is efficiency, is a systems and an engineering problem. Okay, how do you make the OS efficient? Okay, and how do you make it convenient? Okay, they are not necessarily, they may not necessarily go hand in hand. Okay, to make it more convenient, you might have to write additional pieces of software, okay, or add components to the OS, which might add overhead. But if you strip some of those off to make it more efficient and faster, then you will ask your users to interact with your machine at a much lower level of abstraction. But typically you want both, although they may sometimes conflict, but not necessarily. Is that clear? So we will talk about abstractions here, but not necessarily as a software engineering problem. Okay? A lot of the emphasis is actually going to be on resource management and more of the systems and engineering aspect. In other words, we are not going to look at GUIs that OS X or Windows might provide and see how one is better than the other. That's not really what we are going to do. Rather, we are going to deal with lower level components. Okay? Process management, memory management. So all the things that underlie or sit beneath the GUI. Okay, just to make that more explicit. Okay, so, and there is a question of why are you in this course? Okay, yes, it's a required course, but why is it a required course? Because operating system design often gives you perspectives on how to design any large software system. Think of the operating system just as a proxy or one of the many representatives of large software systems that you will encounter in practice. Okay? And the principles that you will study here will apply to other large software systems as well. Okay? Be it database systems or cloud computing or grids computing. All of these are large software systems. Okay? And the principles that apply to the design of one also in many cases apply to the design of others. Okay? So, that's one reason to understand, when you understand how to design any large system, what are the right trade-offs you make between performance and convenience. Okay, I just talked about this on the previous slide, said that the efficiency and usability is essentially the trade-off. Okay, they may sometimes conflict, so you have to design the system in the right way. There's performance and simplicity, there's functionality that you want to provide. Okay. You have to make the right decisions. Okay. This kind of decisions that you will see that we have to make for operating system, same kinds of questions come up when you design any large software system. Okay. How much functionality do you add? What kind of performance do you need? Where do you draw the boundary between functionality and efficiency and overheads? So that's one reason to study operating system. Okay, not just to know about what operating systems are, but to understand what principles make sense when you design large software system. Okay, anyway, OS is an example of a large software system. Typical operating system platforms are millions of lines of code. Okay, some have tens of millions of lines of code like Windows. Okay, so designing such large software system requires you to use certain design principles. And we'll hopefully study some of them in this course. Okay, the other reasons to do this are you want a basic understanding of how your OS works so that you can use your applications in a better way. Okay, so if you understand how the OS manages resources, you can write better applications, okay, that make use of the right functionality. Okay. It is also the intersection point where the hardware and software meet. I already said this on the previous slide, is a piece of software that sits between the hardware and applications. Okay, applications are all the pieces of software that you run. Okay, and the OS sits between hardware and software. So it is basically an interesting systems, interesting piece of software that we want to study that says how do you use all these hardware abstractions, provide better logical abstraction to these applications and processes. Okay. Now, it is, as this slide says, it is not very likely that most of you will be asked to design kernel code. Okay. Maybe a few small numbers of you might actually go and work for some company or some project that requires you to modify a kernel. Okay. Nevertheless, the knowledge of the OS kernel is, as I said, interesting for a variety of reasons that I mentioned on the previous slide. It is an excellent example of how to design large software system. Give you a much better understanding of if something is going wrong on your machine, you understand what is going wrong. Okay? If machine starts thrashing, okay, something that we'll study in this course, you will know why it is doing that. Okay? Because you will have studied memory management principles, you will see where these techniques break down. So you will know what to do to make your machines run better. Okay, whether they are your laptops or servers that you may build for some application down the road. Okay. Now, with that quick introduction to operating systems and just some understanding of why we want to study this topic, to get the best out of this class, you need to have some background. Okay. So you need to have some understanding of the hardware components of your machine. I will do a review of what you should know next time. Okay, so it's going to be a brief review of architecture, but it's assumed that you've taken 201, so you probably should know all of these things. What's in your machine? What does the CPU do? What are registers? What are instruction sets? What are memory hierarchies? What's a system bus? You should have at least heard these terms, if not know about them. Okay, and we'll review them again. Okay. So that's one thing. You need to know something about the hardware in order to know how the OS will manage it. Okay. The other thing is you need programming skills if you are going to do this, all of these assignments, okay, which are going to be approximately half the grade. Okay, so good programming skills are necessary, good understanding of data structures, okay, object-oriented methods, mechanisms and whatnot. Okay. So those are the two things that you really need, which is why 187, okay, which gives you some knowledge of data structures, and 201 are prereqs for this course. Okay. Any questions on this so far? Okay, so I think I mentioned this already, which is building large computer systems, and OS is just an example of large scale system design. And to build any large system, okay, you need to know something about the architecture on which your large system is going to run. You don't need to know C and C++, but you need to know some programming language. Okay, you need to know something about memory management, concurrency, disks, and so on. Okay, if any of you have actually taken a course on database systems or are taking it, you will see that databases also do similar optimization. Okay, they make intricate use of the knowledge of the platform and memory management details in order to optimize resources that are used on the machine. Okay, so these principles will come up again and again. And then this is just one machine. Any large software system today runs on multiple, if not tens or hundreds of machines. Okay, so the principles that we will study towards the end of the course, which is networking and distributed system, give you a very basic introduction to how these large systems work. Okay, how do you design systems like, let's say, the Google search engine, okay, or the Amazon's e-commerce platform that really runs on tens of thousands of machines. Okay, those are extreme examples of highly scalable, concurrent, parallel system. Okay, what are basic principles, what are basic mechanisms that you will use for components to reside on various machines, for them to communicate with one another, so that you can write higher level application. Okay, so we will look at basic network socket communication, we will look at remote procedure calls and remote method invocations, all of the stuff that you nearly need to know from a perspective of distributed system. Okay, that's really the last component of the course. Okay, but that's also an where operating systems have headed and where other large software systems are headed, that typically things don't run on one machine anymore. They are distributed across multiple machines. So you need to understand how to do this well to write these larger applications. Okay. So that's a quick introduction. I want to now do a bit of history. Okay, just to give you an example of how operating systems have evolved over the last 40, 50 years. And basically the way they have evolved has really depended on what it costs, okay, to buy some hardware, what it costs to write some software, and what it costs to hire programmers. Okay. So if you go back really to the 60s, okay, which is when the first operating systems were written, things really ran on very expensive pieces of hardware. Okay, you have to buy a mainframe. Okay, which costs maybe millions of dollars, okay, and it did some very basic computation that your phone can do today, okay, but that's what was the state of the art back in the 60s. So hardware was very, very expensive, okay, and in comparison, programmers were cheap. Okay, probably you could hire a programmer for a few thousand dollars a year, which is basically, if you want take inflation and go backward, that would what a programmer would make back in the 60s. So now if you look, hardware is expensive, programmers are cheap. Okay? Now, what does this mean? So this basically, the hardware wasn't very capable. The operating system allowed one user to work on the console of this machine at any given time. Okay? So your entire system, which costs millions of dollars, would essentially run one process at a time. Okay, in addition to the operating system. Okay, so basically it's one function. There wasn't even any overlap of computation and IO. You could write an application, okay, that would run, and if it had to do some IO, read some data from disk, then the CPU would be idle. Okay, because there's nothing else running there. So if it's only process running and it starts doing IO while it is waiting to read data, nothing is running on your machine. Okay, so you have this very expensive machine that can only run one process at a time, okay, and when this process blocks, the machine is idling. Okay, so you have spent, if you are a company that spent a lot of investment, I mean lot of money on buying this machine, you are not really making good use of your resources. Okay, so basically what that led is operating system designers to say, how can we redesign the operating system so that the same machine can be used in a better way. Okay. So then what operating systems did was they evolved in from single user systems, which is what the first one slide says, to what is called batch processing. What this allowed you to do is now run multiple jobs, as they were called, or multiple processes, one after another. Okay. Still only one process at a time. Okay. But you can then feed a whole bunch of them, and then the machine can execute job A and job B and job C sequentially. Okay. Otherwise a programmer would have to load one program, let it run, and when it's finished, then you load the other program. While you're loading this program, nothing is happening on the machine. So you could just feed a whole batch of them, okay, and then the machine would then execute them one after another. Okay, so you load the program, you run, print the results, repeat. Okay, you would submit jobs on things like punch cards and tape, which I haven't seen, so I presume you haven't seen either. But that was the mode in which you would actually feed programs to the machine. Okay, so but humans were still very much in the loop, and humans could schedule jobs and so on. And the OS functionality was limited to just loading your program, loading data, running your application, and spitting out results. There's nothing interactive here. Okay, so you basically feed data, write a program, program reads some data, does some computation, spits out some results, and you're done. Okay, if you have a bug, then the program crashes, and then the application designer has to figure out what went wrong and rerun. Okay, debuggers are probably not very sophisticated. There's nothing interactive, so no interactive debugging. Okay. So, but this at least made better use of the machine. Although it was still running one program at once, you could actually keep the machine going. Okay. But still, if your machine had, the process had to pause to do I/O, your CPU on this very expensive piece of hardware is still idle. Okay, because any process will do one of two things. It's either doing computation, which means it's either running or wants to run on the CPU, or it is waiting on I/O, which means it cannot run. Okay, so any process that you see, any application is effectively doing one of these two things at any given time. Okay, so if you had these applications that were I/O intensive, okay, they were still not making good use of your CPU on this expensive machine. Presumably you are making good use of the peripherals you attached to the machine, like a disk or something that holds the data, but not the CPU. Okay. So the next stage in the evolution of operating systems was one where the OS could overlap I/O and computation. Okay. So here, to do this effectively, you need to run more than one process at once. If there's only one process running and this process blocks and starts doing I/O, CPU is idle, nothing else to run. Okay. Now if you want to keep the CPU busy, that says you should have more than one things that are ready to run. Okay. So you run process one, while it's running things are fine. If it pauses to do I/O, CPU becomes idle, you immediately start running process two. Okay, while process one does I/O. Process one is finished with I/O, maybe process two will want to do I/O, so you can overlap. Okay. So when something is doing I/O, something else will run on the CPU, and when this thing is doing I/O, you run something. So you can keep all of the components on your expensive machine, okay, busy at all time. Okay. And basically that allows you, number one, to run more jobs and finish more jobs in a given amount of time. It also makes better use of your resources. Yes, you are using all of the, keeping your machine busy, so hopefully you are getting something out of this large investment if you are a company that bought this expensive machine. Okay. So this allows you to do better overlap. Okay. And that has led to this notion of multi-programming. Okay, multi-programming is effectively an abstraction that allows your OS, the OS allows you to run multiple programs at once. Okay. The previous techniques that I mentioned, they are called uniprogramming. Okay, something you don't really see today. Most systems that you see are multi-program system. Okay, so you evolved from a uniprogramming world, or operating systems evolved essentially from a uniprogramming world to a multi-programming world. Okay. Now the multi-programming world, the OS has to have better control on what is happening. So in particular, if multiple jobs have been submitted to the OS, okay, it has to figure out which one to run at what point. Okay, this is the problem of scheduling. Okay, same things that even today's operating systems do. We'll talk about CPU scheduling in a few classes. Okay, it has to protect programs' memory from one another. Okay, if you have multiple programs loaded in memory, one program has a bug, you don't want this program to go and override some other application's memory and corrupt it. So you need memory protection. Again, something that today's operating systems also have to do. So if multiple programs are loaded, you need to protect memory, you need to schedule, and you need to decide which one to resume when CPU is available. Okay, one program halts, you need to then run something else. Okay, you have to provide fairness. You can't just favor some processes and then make other processes stop. Okay, so you have to ensure fairness, scheduling, I/O management. So all of these are functionality that now the operating system has to implement. Okay, so when you go from a uniprogramming to a multi-programming world, okay, resource management becomes important. Okay, whether the resource is the CPU, memory, I/O, you have to start managing them, because there are concurrent or multiple demands on these resources, so you have to arbitrate. Okay, that's what OSs have to do. Okay, so that's how the OS evolved, and you have to design or add all of these things to the OS. Okay. Now, as you add those functionality, the complexity of your OS kernel also increases. Okay, because OS is no longer doing something trivial, which uniprogramming operating systems, very simple. All they're doing is load program, run, okay, and then print results, and you're done. There's nothing to manage because there's only one process running. Okay. When you have multiple processes running, there are a lot more things to manage. Okay. That adds functionality to the OS, but it also adds complexity to the OS. Okay. So OSs became more complex. Okay, there was this operating system called Multics that was designed by GE and MIT. Okay, and this was one of the more complex operating system platforms that they tried to develop. It was a spectacular failure. Okay, became so complex that they couldn't even get a stable version of the OS ready for use. It was very buggy, okay, very unstable, so nobody really ended up using it. Okay, which is really a lesson to learn. Okay, if you try to put too many bells and whistles into your piece of software that you are designing, okay, it becomes more complex, harder to debug, harder to maintain. If it's overly complex, you lose control. Okay, and then basically nobody can use it. Okay, so this was basically a very ambitious project. And then OS designers said, let's step back. Maybe we are trying to do too much. Let's try to do something simpler and do it well. Okay? So a direct descendant from this Multics project was Unix. Okay, Unix basically took some of the best ideas from Multics, but tried to throw away all of the complexity and designed a much simpler kernel that did basically all of what we wanted it to do, which is manage all of the hardware resources, but not make it overly complex. Okay, so that's basically the trade-off or the boundary I was talking about between software engineering and systems design. Okay, you try to make one complex and the other, there's problems on the other end. So you have to draw the boundary at the right way. Okay, OS 360 was IBM's attempt. Okay, these are all, OS 360 is a mainframe operating system. Okay, so those operating systems also became more complex. So when OS 360 was initially released, it had 1,000 known bugs. Okay, it was also buggy, which meant your customers are not happy with you if things don't run. You buy $1 million piece of hardware and then the OS is buggy, it doesn't run. Okay, your customers won't be happy. So you don't want any of this. Okay, you want to design your piece of software in a more scientific way to trade off complexity and functionality, okay, in the appropriate way. So there are many lessons that OS designers have learned as well as system software designers over the years. Okay, these are, and some of them come from these big failures of large projects, okay, OS projects. Okay, now that's 50s and 60s. Okay, in 70s you have basically the technology has changed. Okay, hardware is getting cheaper. Okay, and programmers are not getting cheaper. Okay, programming salaries are rising, cost of hardware is falling. So now you can probably, instead of spending $1 million, you can spend maybe tens of thousands of dollars and buy a piece of machine, okay, some machine. And programmers in the meantime, because of inflation, programmer salary is probably also in the same order or more. Okay. So what that says is you cannot have 100 programmers trying to program one machine, okay, which is now very cheap. You would want to make some small, or may make the OS more efficient so that a small number of programmers can make good use of the machine. Okay? Unlike in the mainframe era where you could basically have a team of maybe 50 people just managing this one machine. Okay? Because you spent a lot of money on it, you want to manage it well. You cannot do that anymore. Okay? So what came with all of this were operating systems that allowed you to do multi-processing and multi-programming. Okay, and they could also be multi-user. Multiple users could log in to the same machine at the same time using terminals. Okay, and they could all use the resources on that machine. Okay, so that's basically the era of Unix. Okay, so Multics took a large number of programmers, 6 years, didn't work. The project was abandoned. As I was mentioning, basically a group of 3 people in Bell Labs designed Unix by taking the best lessons here and designed it in 2 years. Okay, and basically they took out all of the complexity, kept the thing simple, but put some basic functionality. It was clearly a success because this thing lives even today in some shape or form. Okay, any system that you say Linux and whatnot, they're all descendants of Unix in some way. Okay, so basically they introduced, the interesting thing here was they introduced this notion of a shell, okay, which was basically an interactive way to interact with your machine. Okay, so you had the shell, you could type commands, it would execute and bring back some results. Okay, as opposed to you write your program on a bunch of these punch cards and you load it and then 2 hours later some result comes back. Okay, this is more, so you have also this era of interactive computing that came with Unix, okay, that you didn't have with mainframe operating systems and whatnot. Okay, that's an important advance, okay, in the history of operating system, is going from batch processing to interactive processing. Okay. So now as in the 80s, 90s and today, your hardware has become very cheap. Okay, so that's the era of the PC, where people, individuals could afford their own machines. So not organizations that owned computers, individuals could own one too. So you basically have the IBM PC and the Apple Macintosh. All of these were basically born in the 80s, okay, and have continued to be used today. So original operating systems that ran on these personal computers are very basic, as opposed to things that ran on mainframes, which had already gotten quite sophisticated. Okay, these personal computers were very low-end machines. Okay, they couldn't run high-end software. So the early days, DOS and Mac OS X, were basically looked like the mainframe operating systems of the 50s. They allowed you to run only one program. They didn't do any multi-programming. They had uniprogrammed systems. There was no memory protection whatsoever. Okay, the OS, if you had early days of DOS, you ran a process, you could go and override the kernel address space and bring the freeze your system. Okay, there was basically very little in terms of memory protection, virtual memory, and so on. Okay, as PCs have also become more capable, the operating system that ran on PCs started getting all of the features that you seen, that you saw rather, in mainframe operating system, which is you could do concurrent programming, you could have get memory protection, your systems are networked today as file system, could do remote printing, and the most important advance in the world of PC operating system was the addition of a GUI, which started with Windows and other platforms. Okay, so you didn't need to type commands on a shell prompt. Okay, you had a nice graphical user interface that made it much easier for you to interact with the machine. Okay, this basically allowed non-technical users to start using operating systems, or rather personal computers. Okay, because until then you really had to be a tech savvy person to make any good use of your personal computer. Now, the way things stand today is hardware is very cheap. Okay, you can buy a netbook for $200. Okay, so we've gone from $1 million down to $200. Okay, and today's netbook probably does the same thing that mainframes did, or more probably than mainframes did many years ago, okay, many tens of years ago. So hardware is very cheap. People are very expensive. Okay, so you really need the OS to do a lot for you, so you can do very little in terms of managing it and administering it and whatnot. Okay, so now you have multiple machines per user model as opposed to multiple users per machine model. Okay, you probably have at least one laptop, you probably have a smartphone, okay, which is basically a pretty good computational device. You have servers that you access, so you have accessing multiple machines all at once. Okay, so you can no longer afford to have an administrator that manage these things for you. You need to be able to manage it yourselves as much as possible, which essentially means that the OS has to do a lot for you. Okay, you cannot, you are not expected to go and figure out, if you're connecting to a new wireless network, for instance, what you need to do at a low level. Okay, for the OS to connect to your network. You just pick the network, type in the network name, maybe a password. The OS does the right things for you. 20 years ago, to connect to a new network, you really had to go and create an interface and write some configuration files, possibly reboot the machine before you could even recognize that there is a new network. Okay. So you see that functionality has been put in the OS to manage more and more things for you, okay, to make it easier and easier for you to use these things. Okay. So that's one thing. The other thing is, now there are many flavors of operating systems, some very specialized. Okay. What you see on your machine is essentially a general purpose operating system. It's something that's designed to run on a PC. But there are many flavors of these. Okay? There are things called real-time operating system. Okay? They run on mission-critical stuff where there are deadlines that you have to meet. Okay? For example, you could think of the OS that runs on the airplane. The airplane's computing systems, or the OS that controls nuclear reactors, or the OS that controls, let's say, the signaling system for the railways. Okay? You need things to happen in the right time. At the right time. Okay? If not, there can be a catastrophe. Okay? So you have operating systems, special versions of them that are designed to provide very strict guarantees. Okay? They may also be designed to not fail. Okay, so things that, let's say, the OS that runs the stock exchange or a bank's financial system, even if some components fail, the system as a whole continues to run. Okay, so real time, you have fault tolerance, all of that are built into some of these things. Okay, you have at the other end of the spectrum very tiny devices like sensors or embedded systems that also run operating systems of various sorts. Okay, so you might have these devices that are this big. Okay, you don't think of them as computing devices. Nevertheless, they have a tiny microprocessor. They have a tiny kernel. They're doing some computation. Okay, so then you have to ask, what is the right set of functionality to put on this tiny device? Okay, on this embedded system to provide some useful service to its user. Okay, so these are two examples of specialized operating system. There are several others. There are parallel operating systems. There are distributed operating system. Okay, everything from peer-to-peer systems, the web, Google's search engine and cloud, they use some specialized versions of operating systems with specialized functionality. Okay, that allows this application to run on hundreds of thousands of machines at once. Okay, so you have these various flavors. Okay, so when you think of an OS, don't just think of what is running on a desktop or a PC. It's basically the thing that runs on practically anything that has a microprocessor. Okay, even your car has probably several microprocessors with several small operating systems running on it. Okay, you don't think of your car as a computing device. Okay, but more and more the cars are actually turning into devices that are managed by microprocessors for you. Okay, you just drive and it does the rest. Okay, now that's basically your 50-year history. And in that 50 years, basically the thing that has changed really is technology has advanced. And you have basically 9 orders of magnitude improvement in the speed, size and the cost. Okay, cost has come down, speed has gone up, capabilities have increased. Okay, here is just a table that just compares maybe over a period of 15 years, not over this 50 years what has happened. So processors in terms of MIPS speeds have gone from 0.5 to 500. Cost per MIPS, okay, it's gone down from $100,000 per MIP to $500 per MIP. Okay. Memory has gone from 1 megabyte of RAM to gigabytes of RAM. Okay. Network speeds have increased from 10 megabits per second to today it's 10 gig, but gigabits per second. Disk sizes have increased from a gigabyte, okay, which is what you have on RAM today, that's the size of a disk, okay, to a terabyte. Okay. So massive advances in technology. Which is really unprecedented. There's no parallel to this. I mean, pretty much all technologies improve over time. Okay? But 9 orders of magnitude improvement in any given technology, we haven't seen anywhere else. Okay? So if you look at other example like transportation, okay? Over 200 years, okay, speeds of any mode of transportation has gone from 10 miles an hour to, let's say, 1,000 miles an hour. Okay? Communication, which is probably the closest example. Okay? Even there, you look at the speeds at which the networks have evolved, okay, you have 7 orders of magnitude improvement in the speed of communication. Okay? As opposed to this, if you look at any computing device, you have 9 orders of magnitude. You have 100 times more improvement in technology in terms of speed and cost than you see here. Okay? So here's sort of a picture that shows you what 9 orders means. As let's say there's a picture, you zoom out 9 orders of magnitude, this is what you see. This is 1 order, this is 2 orders, 3, 4, 5, 6, that's I think the globe, that's 8 and that's 9. So you're effectively gotten this massive technology improvement has really made all of today's technology possible. So pretty much everything relies on a microprocessor these days. Okay, so then this is really unprecedented in terms of any technology we have seen out there. Okay, there are things that you might have heard like Moore's Law. Processor speeds double every 18 months and so on. So things have actually improved relentlessly over the past 50 years has made this all possible. Okay? And this still continues to evolve. You have multi-core machines. In these days, any laptop you buy has at least 2 cores. Okay? Smartphones are beginning to have multiple processors. Okay? And in 5 years, pretty much you will have maybe tens of processors. What we will do with them, we don't yet know. Okay, there will be applications probably that we haven't seen today that will become possible. You will have memory that you will have lots of RAM, but it will be unreliable. Because as you have more and more components, things become more unreliable. There will be serious power and heat issues. So we will have to think of new trade-offs. Okay? What will we do with all of this computing power? Okay? What should the OS do to make it easy for you to use? What new programming models will we use to use these resources? How will we make sure that all these power heat trade-offs are dealt with in the right way? So in other words, even though we have had 50 years of this evolution of operating system, there's still long ways to go. It's not a mature field, things continue to evolve. So if this is an area of interest for you in terms of research or maybe jobs, I mean, there's still a lot of possibilities in the years ahead. Okay, that's basically the thing to keep in mind. Okay, so that's basically it for today. This was a very quick history lesson. Okay, now what I will do from next time is actually start with an overview of architecture, just review the basics, and then we will start really talking about operating systems. Okay? All right.